The following is a presentation of the Premier Dance Network.
I'm James, and this is The Stage Right Side with James Whiteside, where we'll dive deep into the dark world of dance and come up on the bright side. Oh, that's terrible. Welcome back to The Stage Right Side with James Whiteside. This is James, your host, and this is, can you believe it, season 3 of The Stage Right Side.
Get out.
Yeah, and I'm here with a very special guest and my boss, Kevin McKenzie. Say hello.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Well, we are at the Metropolitan Opera House, and this is my 6th season with ABT. So I actually had my first performance of the season last night. It was Prince Albrecht and Giselle, and it's one of my favorite ballets, and I danced with Cindy, a.k.a. Isabella Boylston, who I obviously adore. And we had a really great time.
Okay, now my first question.
Yeah.
Where does Cindy come from Isabella?
Oh my gosh, this is a tale as old as time. All right, so... it was my first year, 2012, and we became fast friends, and we were texting each other, trying to coordinate a time to meet up and go to lunch or something. And I wrote, "Okay, Cindy." And she wrote back, "Okay, Cindy." And simple as that.
I see. Okay.
We keep trying to think of a more exciting story, but that is legitimately as simple as it gets.
It wasn't something like Cinderella or something.
No, nothing to do with anything logical.
Yeah, okay.
But we have all sorts of variations. We have... Sindelview Maximum Security Prison that we call each other every once in a while, and Sindashian, which is, you know, a play on the Kardashians, yep, which are thank you. Mm-hmm. This one doesn't really have any, you know, place in the family, but we call each other Glagnar every once in a while.
Glagnar,
yes, you know, from a distant planet.
Galaxy.
Yeah. So, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure.
And for donating your time to this. This is something that I've really enjoyed doing over the past couple of years, getting to know people in a very different way, and I'm actually learning a lot about the people that I see on a daily basis, and also getting to learn about people that I don't see so often but want to know more about.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to do with this podcast is just give a glimpse into what dance is right now and have it immortalized in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see us on stage, but you don't really get to hear the dance makers and the dancers and the people behind the scenes, what their lives are about and what they... love about what we do and what they do. So, first off, tell me a little bit about your family. You have like 900 brothers and sisters,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I come from a very large family. I'm the youngest of 11. I started ballet serendipitously and not unlike the movie Billy Elliot. You know, it found me. I didn't like seek it out. The family was not necessarily artistically inclined, but they, you know, it's an Irish crowd, so we sang a lot. You know, there's music. Somehow, I think it's.
Was it a church family?
Yeah, it was. You know, Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, how else do you think we could have 11 kids?
Yeah, I didn't want to assume, yeah. But I assumed.
The Pope says you got to do it, and my father, of all people, who was a meat packer, had no, you know, he's a gregarious guy and whatnot, but no real talent that I could discern other than that he got along with people, you know, overheard me talking with a friend who had discovered tap dance lessons. And he said, "Oh my God, boy, you should go do that. Who knows, you could be the next Fred Astaire." So I did eventually, and I kind of liked it. And, it was at a studio. It was sort of a Dolly Dinko school of dance. You know, it was a local, but a wonderful family. You know, the husband taught acrobatics, and the head of the school was a woman who taught ballet and tap and uh-huh. all kinds of different types of dance. And my sister was taking ballet classes there. Well, my father wanted to see what I knew, and I apparently was not very impressive. And he said, "You don't look terribly coordinated, boy." He said, "I think you should go to your sister's ballet class." And I thought, I am not putting on a pair of tights and going into that room. And his logic was like, well, you know, football players do it. You know, it's, they'll make you listen. The thing is, you want to be a good tapper, right? You know? So he saw it as a means to an end.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my parents, not knowing anything, they gave me private lessons with my sister with that teacher. You said you could go to three classes, and if you, you know, and if you don't want to do it, then you don't want to, you don't have to do it. But do three classes, and by the third class, I was hooked.
Wow.
And after a year, I was giving up the acrobatic team. I was giving up basketball team. I was wanting to spend more time in the ballet studio. And so then my parents looked at one another and said, what the hell are we going to do with this?
You know?
And not unlike the Billy Elliot story, the teacher went to my parents and said, you know, these two kids are really talented. They should get some real training. You know, you should have them evaluated. And But my take on this is that they're way beyond what I can give them.
Wow.
And so, you know, luck was really on my side, you know.
Well, when you have enough people in your court,
yeah,
I mean, there's a lot of opportunities there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, to make a long story short, my mother, to this day, I don't know how she found Mary Day's name or who she was. But they had tried to take us, we were all of 11 and 12 at that point. We had a friend in that local Vermont school who went to the National Ballet Canada school. So they said, well, let's go up there. They have a dormitory. You know, if they take you in, you can live and blah, blah, blah. And they wouldn't take my sister because they said she's going to be too tall. And my mother said, I'm not sending these kids away separately. You know, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And somehow she ended up with Mary Day's name, and who said, oh, let's keep our talent in America. And so we went down to audition for Mary Day. And I can picture it as vividly. This woman was a very charismatic woman. And rather elegant and kind of frightening at the same time. She was imposing her presence.
That's good.
We had choreographed, or rather, I had choreographed a little thing for my sister and I, because I thought that that's what you should do if you, you know. And it was this unbelievably bombastic, you know, I can't remember what the music was, but it was like, you know, Beethoven's Ninth or something, you know. And
drama queen.
And the culmination of it was we ran in this huge crescendo and opposing circles around the entire room, and I landed up on center stage, and she ran in front of me, and I grabbed hold of her leg, and I took hold of her waist, and I grunted as hard as I could, and she picked her foot up off the floor. And that was the big finale. And Mary Day fell off the bench laughing and gave us a scholarship right then, right there. It was the luckiest day of my life, because we got phenomenal training. That school at the time had academics and a dormitory and you know, all of it. So, you know, I was in a student body of 60 people. In any given year, I think the most men were maybe 7 or 8, and in some years I was the only one.
Yeah.
But my class was never more than 12 or 15 people when I was taking history and geometry and all that stuff. But it was an incredible education, because it was preparing you for a life in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
This was a woman who believed that, you know, in the power of the performing arts and how it can transform people. But she believed that you had to teach the whole child, and that ballet was kind of the answer to everything. But she also believed you shouldn't lead people astray. And a perfect story about was taking a young girl who was really talented and taking her aside and saying, now listen here, young lady, you are never going to be in a ballet company. You are really talented, and you need to stay studying this art form. But you mustn't ever think that you're going to be a swan. And that girl turned out to be Shirley MacLaine.
No.
Who was forever grateful to Mary, you know, for, you know, encouraging her to stay in it and stay to be a performer, you know. So that's sort of the atmosphere that I grew up in, That anything was possible, but you had to understand what you were studying. Yeah.
It sounds very different from today's school mentality, for sure.
Very, very different. And it was very holistic. You know, we learned about the history of, I mean, even our academics were geared towards a life in the theater. I remember our ancient history teacher, and she was ancient history. She was so old, but she had this incredible energy about depicting, you know, civilizations in the light of what their culture gave us today. You know, not unlike that wonderful saying of Kennedy's on the, you know, when he said, "We won't be remembered for our wars and our political victories. We will only be remembered for the culture that we leave behind." And so, you know, you learned your history lessons of the ancient Greeks and the Romans and the Huns and the, you know, right up to World War II, through the lens of what artwork was created by these specific civilizations and why, you know. And you go, well, that and who knew? That's all I knew. That's how I thought history was taught.
Yeah.
You know, geometry was related to choreography and architecture. Science class and when you dissected your animal was, you know, the placement of the body and how the ligaments work and how the, you know, it was all geared towards that profession of living in the theater and hopefully being a ballet dancer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a huge gift, you know. So I was a lucky guy.
So that sounds very different from my experience training, but you know, whatever. My question for you is, when you were in that system, were you aware of your ability? Were you, did you know that you were going to be
a
thing?
I didn't. I had an awakening at like 15 where I went, oh my God.
I'm good at this.
I think I could do this.
Yeah.
You know? But by then, and you know, and you have to understand, I never had seen a professional ballet company until I had danced on a stage with a live orchestra before I had seen a professional ballet company. She put us on with the National Symphony. She did a Nutcracker. You know, I mean, she gave us huge opportunities.
Yeah.
But it was during the years that, before Kennedy Center was built, when Ballet Theater came through town, they would use our studios to rehearse for their, when they were performing at Carter Barron or wherever they performed in D.C. So there I was watching, you know, as a student of, you know, all of 14, you know, Eric Brune and Carlo Fracci rehearsing their first act of Giselle, and Ivan Nagy and Natalia Makarova rehearsing their second act of Giselle, and so really up close and personal. And I had a revelation at about 15 that after the Kennedy Center, I'm getting my timeline mixed up, but I know that I was around 15. I watched ballet theater and I thought, that's what I want to do. And it's not the dancing part. It's the fact that you can be an actor without words, that you can move people, that I can hear, I can go to see Giselle or Swanlick or whatever the ballet that was running, see these amazing artists, and it was a different take on it every night. But they said what they said as clearly it spoke directly to me sitting there in that audience. And I thought, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And not long after that, I realized, you know, I might, in fact, be good enough to do that. So I just put my focus on that. And, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. You know, I'd like to be able to say, you know, oh, I was all sage and whatnot. But in retrospect, I think I was remarkably patient as a young person, which makes me think
you're still incredibly patient, FYI.
No, but I think I had a belief in a sort of hubris type of way. I had a belief that I was going to get where I wanted to get. I just needed to be patient and pay my dues.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of what happened.
Yeah.
Very
simple.
But in the meantime, while I was being patient, I was absorbing the likes of, you know, these giants of the 20th century that kind of, it's the likes of which no longer exist.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's not unlike, you know, our culture has changed to this point now where it's a little bit like when the silent movies went talkie, you know, or when black and white went to color. there, today we're all about demystifying everything. So, you know, one of the powers of a performer or of a persona in the public realm is there's a mystery to them. There's a certain self-possession that's really compelling. It makes people lean in and want to understand you. I will be forever grateful for having learned that by example from the masters, if you will. So it made a very big impression on me. I find today it's really difficult to convey that sentiment because I'm like the bridge between that generation and your generation.
Yeah.
You know, it's I think you all, to some degree, understand me. If through a humorous way,
I mean, it makes sense.
But,
it's just...
but understanding what I knew from them, I think, is a foreign place for many of today's artists. Meaning, you know, how does one really convey what being in love is? How does one really convey what listening to another artist in an art form that doesn't use words mean? So it's fascinating, you know, and I am forever grateful that I have that I had that input, and now my as you mentioned, you say patient. I'm fascinated by the task of trying to convey that message and understand that I can't, that I have yet not found a way to make it succinct. But I think that that's part of a, you know, I don't know. I think that's part of the process and the beauty of this art form with every generation.
So do you mean personally or studio-wise? Because I feel today it's really valuable for, at least, I mean, this is my approach, to be as a person very honest and very... I am not shrouded in mystery, and I am very comfortable in that, being that way.
No, I'm not talking about being as a person. I'm talking about as a persona. As you know,
I don't feel like those things are separate anymore. Perhaps
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. But one can't deny when one goes to a movie and sees a great actor, or Meryl Streep. You think you know Meryl, but every time you go to see her, she is a different persona. And what makes her a compelling actress is that she has grasped the mystery of the person she's playing. One of the things that has helped the performing arts to some degree and hurt it, I think, as much is the 15 minutes of fame. Everybody wants that 15 minutes of fame, and they're willing to tell anything about themselves. And sometimes it's good to withhold something for yourself, because then it's just your work that's being viewed, not the person that people think they know doing the work that you're doing.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. That's very difficult in our current world.
It is.
Because, in all honesty, the majority of interest comes from an angle.
Yeah.
So, in a perfect world, I would love for that so much to be true. But it is, unfortunately, not the world in which we are living.
I completely agree. And that's the big challenge about how to keep this particular art form vibrant and relevant.
Yeah. And with that, I'd like to segue into 100 years later, and I'd like to talk about your gala programming for this upcoming Monday. And I have to say it's the most out there programming that I've experienced since I've joined, and I want to talk to you about your decision to program each piece, starting with the restaging of Harlequinade by Alexei Romansky. How did that conversation start, and how did you decide that it was a go?
For the gala or for the ballet itself?
For the ballet itself.
Well, it's something that he and I had been talking about for years. He had cited this year as Petit Pas' 200th anniversary years ago. I think it was before we did The Sleeping Beauty. And when he got into the...
Hold, please.
So Alexei mentioned Harlequinade as a potential ballet to honor the 200th anniversary of Petit Pas in 2018. And as we were going through that process of Sleeping Beauty, I was stunned to discover that ballet that I thought I knew so well. I mean, I had staged a version of my own and realized, how did we get from this place, if this is the reconstruction of what it was, or as close as we can get to it, it's, you know, that's day, and where we have come and believe Sleeping Beauty to be is night. You know, how did we get, so much was lost, you know?
It's a game of telephone.
Yeah, it's exactly. So I thought, you know, if he's got the ability to revive a ballet that was the last work of Petit Pas on his 200th anniversary, we're going to do that. You know, just tell me, how do we, where do we start? How do we get that? You know, should we design it new? Should we, if we're going to reconstruct it, should we reconstruct the original designs also? So we just, it just captured my imagination. I thought, you know, honor, there were two reasons. You know, we want to honor a master, but it was more in my, I can't think of the word, my reverence for Alexei as a master, paying obeisance to a master. And I thought, this exercise is giving him the tools for his own choreography that make me suspect that there is going to be a masterpiece or three from him of his own devising that we can't imagine yet. But this is part of that process. And in the meantime, he's showing us our own heritage.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a, it's like AncestryDNA.com, you know? It's, you know. It's,
have you ever done that, by the way?
I haven't.
No,
I haven't.
Either.
Yeah. But it's, so there was that. So I went, yes, let's, absolutely, let's do that.
Excellent.
But then the...
what about Michelle? Michelle Dorenz has
You know,
a triptych of pieces
coming
up.
Yeah, I, well, you know, I started as a tap dancer.
Yeah.
And every time I've seen her work, I'm just so riveted. And,
yeah.
And it's not... She's more than just a tap dancer.
Yeah.
And serendipitously, I was... this year is still my 25th anniversary as director of ABT.
Yeah.
And when it started, everybody was going to try to find a hook, you know, to celebrate it. And they were going, oh, let's get you on stage. And I was like, no, no, let's not do that. let's have a lot of new work. And I'm proud to say this is in this season, we have 5 world premieres starting in September until we finish the Met. That's unprecedented for us. So, you know, that's a gift I can't imagine. You know, that's fabulous. So let's celebrate it that way. But I was on my way to the Vail Festival last year because many ABT dancers have danced there for years and years and years, and I had just never been. And I thought, this is getting embarrassing. I need to go there and see what's happening, you know? And I know Damien, and I, you know, it's crazy. And, we were trying to figure out what to do. We needed a piece d'occasion for this gala because I knew that we were going to do a Harlequinade excerpt in anticipation of the world premiere, and I knew that we were going to do
After Right. Which is the new Wayne McGregor ballet,
and we'll talk about that in a bit. and I realized that Michelle was going to be at the Vail Festival, and I was with our executive director, Kara, on the way to the airport, and I said, you know what I would really like for my 25th anniversary? I'd like to see which one of our dancers could tap. And thinking that I was going to go there and ask her, would she just do a little thing for, because of the you tap, and David Albert taps, and Craig Salstein taps, you know, I thought, oh, we could do a fun little, you know, tapathon for Kevin. And And then I got there and saw the work that she was doing, and I thought, okay, jettison the light Tabitha and for Kevin idea. This could be the Twyla Tharp, Robert Joffrey moment redux. To put the artist of our caliber in a room with her and see what she can come up with. I think that they will challenge her and she will challenge them. That's where surprising art happens. So we just, I just said, well, it's unfair to, give you a piece d'occasion and say, throw you throw you half an hour of time and say, good luck, I hope it goes well. So we thought, well, let's build something over time. And I want it to realize as a full work. Either that this part of it will just simply be a workshop for her to get to know us and it'll evolve into something else, or she'll build on this. Who knows? And that's what I love about it. Who knows? But when you get in the studio and see what's going on, it's pretty terrific.
Yeah,
it's infectious.
Exceptional. Yeah.
Yeah, it's infectious. That's exactly what, that's the word I can't, it's like you just, you see and experience and feel things that redefine your notion of what classicism is, because she's a present day classic. And, if I were going to be a marketing machine, I would say that this gala, I always think that these things after the fact, I wish that I could claim that I had this idea and that's why I put it together. But, I usually put them together and then I go, what's special about this?
What is this?
It's the three words of our title. Because Michelle's the American part on this gala. Alexei's the ballet part on this gala. And Wayne's Afterwrite is the theater part on this gala. He's creating a shockingly different take on Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. He's somebody that I'd wanted to engage for the company for a long time.
And why did it just happen now?
Well, I got a bugaboo. From time to time I go through our old archives and I look at our curation list and I refurbish it, and I'm always juggling certain works that I think need to be kept alive. But some works are dated and they need to be, it's tricky when to bring them back. You can bring them back when they're historic or a period piece, but you can bring them back at the wrong time and they just won't work. And I thought of Rite of Spring. For a variety of reasons, and I thought I should take a look, because we have a production of Glenn Tetley's that was fabulously popular in the 70s and 80s. And I thought, I wonder if that, what category that's in. And as soon as I started to hear the music, I thought, you know what? That's what Wayne should do for this company, because it's, the music is so outrageous, and his vocabulary is so outrageous. And he's always worked, to my knowledge, to a commission score. And I thought it might be a really cool challenge for him to have to exist within something that was
already created,
preordained, if you will. Especially, anyway, and it turned out when I approached him that he had already been commissioned to do a Rite of Spring. And then it got canceled.
May I ask by whom?
The Bolshoi. It was at the time of Sergei Filin's disaster, and the theater just, he just couldn't get traction, and So he reimagined, and what he was imagining for them has nothing to do with what we're about to realize.
And so, as you know, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but there is sensitive material in this new work.
Yeah, the thing is, Wayne has done is not necessarily take the libretto of the music of the Rite of Spring, that it's springtime and pagan ceremony and we got to get a sacrifice so the harvest is good, but he has taken a very strong subject of the mystery of a lost civilization from a part of the world that had so many interesting things going on, right down to the fact that this civilization sort of shared one common trait in that they all, or many of them, had a particular strain of cancer. This just fascinated him to the point where he went, I don't want to do a rite of spring. I want to use the music and see what it informs me, but I'm fascinated about that lost civilization.
Uh-huh.
What happened there? And he has, I think, engaged his imagination and explored what could maybe have happened.
Yeah. I mean, as a dancer, it's incredibly thrilling and feels, I don't know, it creates an energy that perhaps we're not all used to, and it's exciting, simply put. So we're having a good time in the studio. We just ran it right before I came up here, honestly.
Great. And when we see the sets and whatnot within it, it will change entirely also.
Yeah.
Because I think it has the potential to have to be in a very contemporary vocabulary, a dark, serious look at human / nature.
Yeah.
And the way it interacts. But it's much in the same way that Tudor's works.
Yeah.
Did.
What a drama queen.
Yeah.
All right. I want to get back to a little bit of your history. Mm-hmm. And I have a couple questions about directorship and, you know, all of that. So you were a principal dancer here for how long?
12 years.
12 years. And was there one moment that you felt you really had become the artist you wanted to be?
Yeah, actually there was. It was really through the Romeo project, if you will. Because up until that time I was in my time, the word, you know, danseur noble was, mm-hmm. you know, bandied about. I had an affinity for the Albrechts and the Siegfrieds and mm-hmm. But when I did Romeo, I realized, oh my God, I'm playing a human being. I'm not playing a fictitious character. I mean, yes, Romeo is you know, from a play. He's mm-hmm. not a real person. But I wasn't falling in love with a dead, you know, person, or whatever. So early on in my career, I had a difficult time marrying my want and need to make the acting scenes really clear with the style of the dance that I was doing. And I remember Mikhail Baryshnikov saying, Giselle once, he said, my God, I get it, I get your story, but you know, it's like in the mime scenes you look like an actor who's never had a dance lesson in his life, and then suddenly you become like Eric Brune when the music starts with a variation, you know, can you just meld them a little bit here, you know? And and I didn't have to do that for Romeo.
Yeah.
However, the stakes were high. I suddenly realized there were two events. That helped me realize that I could bring something to the classics, and I could bring something of the classics to Romeo. And at the same time, I worked with Yuri Killian for the first time, and I discovered a vocabulary and a certain physicality
mm-hmm.
that made me understand what plié actually was all about. You know, it wasn't a position, it was an action.
Yeah.
And I came into contact for the first time, and I was in my early 30s, with and socialized with a very different group of people. They were musicians and artists and actors mainly.
And that was in the 80s?
Yeah. And so I began to connect the dots between all of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a moment when I finally went, wow, this is what it's about, you know. I better enjoy this because I'm discovering this late. You know, by the time I really put it together, I was probably 35, 36.
Wow.
And I went, you always said to yourself, you're gonna try and get to 40, and if you take good care of yourself, you'll get beyond it.
Uh-huh.
But my sister that trained with me,
uh-huh.
her job was to tell me when it was time
yeah.
to, you know, hang it up. And she How old was. Were you? I was 36. Oh, at the time I hung it up, I was 38. Turned out.
Wow.
And dancing the best I'd ever danced. But I woke up one morning. I had left ballet theater at that time, and I really thought that I was going to be a choreographer. I was impassioned about trying to make dances.
Uh-huh.
And I went back to my alma mater, to Mary Day, who was at that point then like in her 90s. And she was looking, she had given the school up
uh-huh.
when the drug culture took over. She said, okay, that's going away.
Uh-huh.
And she started a small company and centered it around Chu San Go, the Vietnamese choreographer that kind of, he was a big breakthrough. And he sadly died very young of AIDS. So she was looking for... She thought that she was going to turn this thing over, and then suddenly she had to sort of really re-engage in her very late 80s.
Wow.
And so she invited me to come back. And I danced and was associate director there and choreographed and did the schedule and uh-huh. was sat in on planning meetings. I was doing an apprenticeship as a director without yeah. knowing what I was doing. But I was excited by the fact that she was... you know, really preparing to hand this thing over to me.
Uh-huh.
I didn't quite comprehend what it would mean to run a company. I was just excited that I could have a company and access to really good dancers to choreograph on. And at that time, Jane Herman was director of ABT, mm-hmm. and she had announced she's leaving, mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. And somewhere around April of 92. Martine, my wife Martine, said, you know, I've heard through the grapevine that your name is on the search list for ABT. And I was like, well, that's flattering. You know, that's great. Isn't that nice, you know?
And you didn't take it seriously?
I didn't take it seriously. Well, I thought, who the hell would call me to direct ABT, you know? There were so many people who could, you know... What were these people needed to get their heads on straight, you know? So I continued on. And then in August of that year, we were doing a long drive, and she quietly said, you know, ABT's not announcing anybody. It's been directorless now for 6 months. You know, I mean, are you prepared for them to give you, I mean, what are you going to do if they call you? You know, you may think it's a joke, but they may actually get down to your name,
yeah.
you know? And I was like, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, you know, just wouldn't do it. And literally, it was within a couple weeks, I literally woke up, we were going into the season with Washington Ballet, starting another season, and I woke up one morning and I went, it's over. I don't need to perform.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done. So I marched in and said to Mary, I think we need to take me off this guy. I need to concentrate on teaching and coaching uh-huh, and choreographing, uh-huh. and that's what I want to do, you know. And it's like, to prolong it, and the irony is, you know, as Eric Broome said, the irony is, you know, of a dancer is just when you hit that place of full cognizant recognition of what your art means, your body starts to betray you. And my body hadn't really started to betray me yet. I had that earlier, you know, but I was dancing with ease. I remember thinking, God, if I knew now what I had, if I could have known then what I know now, I would have, you know,
there's no way.
Changed the world, you know. But so she accepted it, and she was fine. And the next week, Ballet Theatre called.
And they basically said, do you want the job?
No. No, they had called to ask me if I would come and have a lunch with Gerald Arpino, who was the director of the Joffrey, because Ballet Theatre and Joffrey were considering merging.
Huh.
And I said to them, I think that is a spectacularly bad idea. And they were shocked. They said, but, you know, but both companies are in dire straits financially. If we pool our resources, we'll be... And I said, and the moment you're not Joffrey or ABT, you're nothing. What you've got are two warehouses of smelly costumes. You know, you have to start all over, you know. And they said, well, that's the thing. We thought maybe you and Jerry could, you know, mm-hmm. co-direct it. And I was like, oh,
I don't want to do that. Yeah.
You know? And it's not so much that I didn't want to share. because I didn't know anything, you know. And he was, you know, he had hired me. I mean, he was my boss from 15 years previous. And anyway, so I thought, you know what, Ballet Theatre deserves it. They gave me my artistic identity. I'll go, you know, without going through any assumptions, presumptions, I'll go talk. So I listened to the vision, and I listened to Jerry, and they brought me into the boardroom, and they said, so, what's your recommendation? And I said, I think ABT should go it alone. ABT has a great repertoire, it has a great roster of dancers, and it could run for two more years without an artistic director, basically. What you need is an executive director. What you need is a business plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
And I said, thank you very much. So I walked away feeling I did my duty. You know? I'm going back to Washington. I'm going to start my new life. You know, and a month later, they called up and said, the chairman of ABT called and asked me to come and interview for the job.
What was the interview like?
He sat me down and said, listen, I'm the person who put you last on the list. I need you to know that the dancers put you at the top of the list.
And why do you think they did?
Well, I think in my last years, I was a pretty good example. You know, I was one of those bunheads that, you know, I had the, because of my training, I had the etiquette of the theater. I carried it with me. I was many times the person in a full run of rehearsal that would yell at the peasants and say, don't turn your back on me. I'm the prince.
Uh-huh.
He would have you, you know,
yeah.
and somehow they would buy it. You know, it's like, cause if you're not telling us, it looks like you finished your dance and you're going on and then, you know, so, and all my partners, trusted me. They, you know, Martine always said I would coach her while I partnered her. You know, it was just, I don't know. I think I just displayed
leadership
quality.
Yeah.
And
thing is, okay, I'm going to interject for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Those all make sense to me. All of those traits. But as a principal dancer in this company, I'm afraid to speak to people in this way because perhaps it's a fear of not being liked, or I don't know, I just feel like company culture is perhaps different, and I am reticent to ask people for such things. You know, don't turn your back on me here, I'm the prince, you know. Or is that the company, or the time, or what, or was it just something that was specific to you? Because honestly, in most other things, I feel comfortable asking for what I need.
But you know, and you feel comfortable doing that when you know you're right, correct?
I do, but it also has to do with my audience.
Right, right. But, well, I guess the times when I knew I was right, I didn't care what the audience was.
Yeah, okay.
Because I knew that if somebody challenged it, that I could go, hey, I'm not trying to do this for my ego.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do it for the storytelling of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense. I would prepare to argue my
case
with my peers, you know. And I guess because I had so much support from coaches and whatnot that I, you know, it was like, I don't know. It wasn't from an arrogance. It was just, you know, that's, it just,
it made sense.
It just made sense at the time. And I was able to sort of convey, like, you wouldn't do that at a party.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You just wouldn't do it. You'd say, excuse me, I have to go, you know? And if it was the Prince of Wales, you would do more than, excuse me, I have to go.
You wouldn't leave.
Right. So that's my point, you know? And they all,
well, that makes sense.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah,
see your point.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think it was because it was about the work.
Yeah.
Not about hierarchy.
Yeah. No, I mean,
yeah.
That makes complete sense to me, and I agree with it. I'm just saying, personally, it scares me.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, through time, one begins to own your ground from which you build your various personas that you are portraying. And they either work and resonate or they don't. And if they don't, then you have more work to do. If they do, then you're perfectly within your right to go, hey, I could use a little support here, guys. Mm-hmm. and you do that. You do that. You're good at that. You say, you know, hey, I could use a little support, or I'm not sure what to do here. But I think it's just degrees. And again, it's just a different time. This is a different time.
And what specifically pertaining to this is different? Like, what about my demeanor and other principal dancers' demeanor is different from your generation's? Or our ability to speak to one another, or
you know, actually, I think what's interesting is that I think there's less ego now.
Without a doubt, I agree.
Far
completely.
Less ego now.
But I think that stems from directly your generation, because we witnessed things and we heard stories about all these huge personas, these big egos, mm-hmm. and it scared the shit out of us. And so we are working really hard. It's like, we're fighting to not become our parents.
Right, right. But the thing is, and if I may take a little bit of credit, as a director, I worked with all those people. And I respected their art. I didn't respect when they got self-indulgent and wouldn't put up with it. And there was one artist that shall remain nameless that I finally said, you know what? I don't care how talented you are. What you know, you're far more gifted than I will ever be. But I don't want to live my life with you because you are a mess. You need to go get a different partner. You know. And by the way, that's called a partner, not a slave. And I knew that I was in a position that if I walked away from it, that was kind of going to start the downfall because no one else would work with her.
Yeah. Wow.
And there comes a point where, you know, there's artistic temperament and there's just plain petty self-involvement.
I mean, we've discussed
and,
this.
Yeah. So you just go, you just have to insist on that with people to say, yeah. You know, just being crazy isn't part and parcel of being talented.
Yeah.
It's just,
amen.
It's, and somehow I think that you're right. Every other generation has, you know, you relate to your grandparents more
yeah.
than your parents. And I think that that, you know, you in a funny way, yeah, I would be your parents and then, yeah, they would be the grandparents. But I was, I reacted to them and you're, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, I find that you all are very respectful of one another. You're respectful of each other's space. And that you actually delve in and help one another. Sometimes we wouldn't. I mean, I did personally, and I had other colleagues do it with me. And I, you know, even Misha, you know, so he invited people to, you know, say things, and he was always very good with, you know, insights, but of course he was the boss, but he was also a peer because we would share roles.
Yeah.
That
must be such a strange dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, I don't know. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to analyze that because it's,
I mean,
you know, there was professional, I'm sure you guys have professional jealousies, but you have you personally don't have it affect your existence.
I mean, you try to rise above that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, professional jealousy is incredibly motivating
yeah.
and necessary to achieve where you want to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like most of us wouldn't be here without it. But at the same time, it's like mastering emotions.
That's exactly it. Because in the end, the thing that makes a great artist and a great company is that there is something spiritual, something attached to whatever one would define as the divine in this art form. There's something larger than any of us that we're tapping into. And it's the people who believe it's all about them is what makes it go off the rails. You know? It's the tail wagging the dog.
It's the chicken versus the egg.
Yeah.
All right, one more thing. Why did you accept the job for director?
Well, you know, Steve Friedman, that chairman, put it, he said, you've nothing... I was very hesitant. And he said, you've nothing to lose. You have no reputation as a manager. What you are perceived to be is a great former dancer. So no one would fault you if you didn't succeed, because you have your relative youth and your inexperience in managing anything.
You have an opportunity to be a prodigy,
right,
essentially.
Right. So, and the truth of the matter is, I have asked every single person with the qualifications to do it, and they don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole because, quote-unquote, I don't want to preside over the downfall of ballet theater. He said, you are in a unique position to not have it affect you if you fail. And I thought about it for a while, and there was part of me that said, you know, so the alternative is if I don't do it? And he said, I kind of have to close the... I'm out of options, you know?
Wow.
And so I thought about that further, and I thought, you know, I owe ABT that, to try to do whatever. And then, at the time, I was smoking, and I said, do you mind if I smoke the entire cigarette in silence? And he finally interrupted it and said, you know, there's a lot of free food involved. And I thought, I can work with this guy. And we did. And the thing is, it worked because everybody realized that I was the symbol for the salvation. Everybody needed me to succeed. Mm-hmm. Every dancer, every receptionist, the janitors, the stagehands, the orchestra, they all needed me to succeed. And I made wildly foolish mistakes in the first 2 or 3 years. But everybody,
they just went,
you know, he's better him than me. You know, he's on a learning curve. And
you took over in the 90s, and I mean, the 80s were incredibly drug-addled. How did you deal with dancers who had addiction issues and, navigate that world? Because that was the culture at the time.
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure how I...
There was no HR, right?
No, there was no... I was the HR. In hindsight, again, I realized that many of my best lessons as a manager came from observing people's abhorrent behavior in the 80s. And I remember just filing it away, going like, if I'm ever in a position of responsibility, I will never allow that to happen. You know, or I will never treat people like that. You know, it was all the negative lessons, and that's when it came to fore. Because when I first had to confront it, I was like, I'm really sorry, but this, you have to go away and fix this if you want to keep your job.
Yeah.
You know, I know something about addiction here, and if you don't have to lose something, you will not change your ways. So you are going to lose your job, and if you want to keep it, all you have to do is get treatment and allow us to have access to the people who are giving you treatment,
mm-hmm.
and keep you honest. And if you cheat on it, you lose your job. It's as simple as that. And it was pretty effective. And then the other one that was really difficult that I had never had any experience with, I had subliminal experience, but I didn't actively understand what it was eating disorders, and realized, oh my God, it's just like a drug addiction, you know?
Hmm.
So that was all on the job learning curve. Yeah.
Sounds exhausting and terrifying.
Yeah. It's a miracle the company survives the first 5 years of my directorship. It's a freaking miracle.
Will of the warrior. ABT has the will of the warrior, without a doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I really, really appreciate the candid conversation, and it was illuminating and just downright interesting.
Great.
And, just generationally, there are so many parallels, and then there are so many things that I just have question marks all over the place about, and I don't know that I'll get to the bottom of them, and I think that's okay.
Listen, the thing is to ask the questions.
Yeah.
That's the only way you figure it out, you know? And the thing is, sometimes there isn't an answer. As I get older, I realize, you know, I'm an old bohemian from way back. You know, I'm a bit of a rebel. As much as I am a traditionalist, I was a bit of a rebel. But I come to find that there is a huge strength in the power of faith. And I don't mean religion, and you know, but having faith that if you are honest with yourself, you can be completely not in control of your life, but you can always be better, and that you will, in fact, you have to have faith that you will be better. If you have no faith that you won't, then it's all just graphs and statistics and soul-sucking, you know, stuff.
Yeah.
Or another word is belief, if that's more palatable, you know?
Well, in a way, I feel like will is the best word, for me at least. I feel will is a powerful force, and when you feel your will slipping is when you lose the will to be better.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't want that. I don't know about you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the most important thing for anybody, as an artist in particular, but as a person in general, is making that clear distinction that there's a difference between a gift and a talent.
Uh-huh.
And talent is the ability to realize a gift. The gift is irrelevant. It's the talent that's important.
Yeah.
And the best gift you can give yourself is discovering the art of consistency. Because the art of consistency is rooted in discipline and joy. And if you have those two things working in tandem, you can have good days and bad days, but nobody can stop you.
That sounds like a damn good plan. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Yeah,
and cheers to 7 more weeks of madness.
We're at that point of six. What we're down, 4 down and 60 to go.
Oh, good God, that's daunting. All right, tune in next week, and our guest will be Michelle Dorrance.
Woohoo!